Welcome to the debate. You know, in property law, there is this really fascinating doctrine regarding fixtures.
Oh, right. Where you attach personal property to a wall.
Exactly. If you take a piece of personal property and attach it securely enough, legally speaking, it actually stops being personal property. It becomes part of the architecture itself.
Yeah, and it alters the fundamental nature of the room. The critical thing about a fixture is that once it's there, anyone who walks into that room has to reckon with it. You know, they can't just slide it out of the way to make space for themselves. It essentially dictates the environment.
Which brings us directly to the core of what we are examining today. We're looking at the deeply fractured 9-8 and bank decision handed down by the Fifth Circuit in Nathan versus Alamo Heights Independent School District. This just came down on April 21st, 2026.
A massive case.
Yeah, it really is. The court upheld Texas Senate Bill 10, and for our listeners, SB 10 is a state law mandating that every public elementary and secondary school display a 16 by 20 inch framed poster of the King James Version of the Ten Commandments in a conspicuous place in every single classroom.
Right, so it's a decision that literally forces us to ask what happens when religious scripture becomes, you know, a mandatory fixture of public school architecture.
Exactly. So our essential question today is this. Was the Fifth Circuit en banc majority correct in upholding SB 10? To answer that, we have to unpack whether the Supreme Court's 2022 decision in Kennedy v. Bremerton completely destroyed previous school display precedents.
Specifically, the 1980 case, Stone v. Graham.
Right. We also need to map the exact contours of the establishment and free exercise clauses when you're dealing with compulsory public schools. And of course, we have to navigate the incredibly steep threshold question of standing. So briefly, I'll be arguing that the majority correctly applied the new historical hallmarks test to uphold what is, at the end of the day, a passive display.
And I will be taking the position that the Fifth Circuit majority severely overstepped. I'll argue that the court violated the strict rule of vertical star decisis and, frankly, just ignored the inherently coercive nature of state-mandated sectarian texts in a room full of captive children.
Okay, so let's lay out the broad strokes of our positions before we really get into the weeds here. From my perspective, Judge Duncan's majority opinion correctly recognized that we are living through a sea change in First Amendment jurisprudence. I mean, for decades, Establishment Clause cases were governed by the Lemon Test.
The infamous Lemon Test.
Right, which asked courts to act as, you know, amateur psychologists to figure out if a law had a secular purpose. But in Kennedy v. Bremerton, the Supreme Court explicitly abandoned Lemon, and because the 1980 decision Stone v. Graham relied entirely on that now-dead Lemon Test to strike down a nearly identical Kentucky law, well, Stone is effectively a dead letter.
Supposedly a dead letter, anyway.
Effectively, yes. So once you clear away that jurisprudential deadwood, you apply the correct historical hallmarks framework. This is drawn from Justice Gorsuch's concurrence in Shurtleff. Under that framework, a passive poster just doesn't constitute an establishment of religion.
But is it passive?
Well, furthermore, looking at the recent Mahmoud v. Taylor decision, a passive display on a wall isn't a compulsory curriculum, so it doesn't violate the free exercise clause or the rights of parents.
I approach this from an entirely different angle, starting with the very basic architecture of the federal judiciary. The en banc majority fundamentally overstepped its jurisdictional bounds here. Relying on Judge Ramirez's and Judge Haynes's incredibly sharp dissents, the absolute rule of vertical star decisis dictates that lower courts cannot implicitly overrule a directly on-point Supreme Court precedent.
Even if the underlying logic is gone?
Even then, Stone v. Graham has not been explicitly overturned by the Supreme Court. Therefore, it remains binding law. But even if we indulge the majority's historical analysis for a second, they completely fail to account for the unique captive audience environment of public schools.
The coercion argument.
Right. As Judge Southwick noted in his dissent, mandatory daily exposure to sectarian scripture is inherently coercive. On top of that, Texas's explicit choice of the Protestant King James Version, that violates the prohibition against denominational preference established in Larson v. Valente. And, you know, the lack of any opt-out mechanism creates a severe, unavoidable burden on parents' free exercise rights.
Okay, well, let's actually start right at the courtroom door, because before we can even debate whether the Constitution was violated, we really have to figure out if these specific plaintiffs have the right to sue in federal court in the first place. Standing is the foundational mechanism here.
It is, yeah.
Now, the majority found that the plaintiffs had standing based on their compulsory exposure to these texts. But Judges Ho, Oldham, and Willett correctly pointed out the massive mechanical flaw in the plaintiff's case. They brought what's called a facial pre-enforcement challenge against a passive display.
Which means they didn't wait for a student to actually be disciplined or explicitly harmed.
Exactly. They are trying to strike down the law before it really takes effect, arguing that the text of the law itself is fundamentally unconstitutional in every conceivable application. Judge Oldham noted that succeeding in this posture is the legal equivalent of converting a 7-10 split in bowling.
It is a notoriously high bar. I mean, you have to prove there is no set of circumstances under which the law is valid.
Right. And more fundamentally, this borders dangerously on offended observer standing. The plaintiffs are essentially arguing that they will experience a psychological consequence from observing texts they disagree with. The Supreme Court has highly disfavored that theory of standing since Valley Forge back in 1982.
But, I mean,
the logic is simple, right? A federal court is not a debate club for airing grievances about ideological offense. If simply seeing something you don't like gave you the right to sue, the federal dockets would paralyze the government.
I hear that. But look at the reality of the environment we're talking about. You cannot classify these plaintiffs as mere offended observers. We're not talking about a casual passerby in a public park who happens to see a monument, gets offended, and, you know, just walks away.
Sure, it's a school.
It's a public school. We are talking about children mandated by state truant law to sit in a specific room staring at a specific wall for 8 hours a day. The compulsory nature of schooling makes the injury imminent and direct.
But they aren't being asked to physically interact with the poster. They don't have to salute it.
They don't have to salute it, but they cannot look away. And they certainly cannot leave the room without facing disciplinary action. This isn't just about taking offense. The Supreme Court, in cases like Abington v. Shemp and Levy Wiseman, explicitly recognized that students in public schools have standing to challenge religious exercises precisely because the machinery of the state is holding them in place.
Yeah, the captive audience doctrine.
Exactly. The injury isn't, I saw something I didn't like. The injury is, the state is using its coercive power to trap me in a room while it broadcasts a sectarian message.
Well, okay, if we assume for a moment that the captive nature of the classroom gives them standing, that immediately forces the Fifth Circuit into an incredibly tight corner regarding the governing law. And this is where the procedural debate gets really fascinating for law students and professors. If these kids are injured, the court has to figure out what to do with Stone versus Graham.
Right. The 1980 case.
Yeah. In 1980, the Supreme Court struck down a Kentucky law mandating Ten Commandments displays in classrooms. But the vital piece of context is how they struck it down. They used the Lemon Test, specifically reasoning that the Kentucky law lacked a secular legislative purpose.
The first prong of Lemon.
Right. Now, fast forward to 2022, and the Supreme Court in Kennedy v. Bremerton explicitly states that the Lemon Test and its focus on secular purposes and endorsements is completely abandoned.
Yes, Lemon was abandoned, but Stone was not.
But look at the mechanics of the decision. If Stone is entirely built on the foundation of the Lemon Test, and the Supreme Court explicitly brought out the wrecking ball for Lemon in Kennedy, aren't we asking lower courts to engage in a charade?
I wouldn't call it a charade.
Well, the reasoning of Stone is the Lemon Test. With Lemon gone, there's absolutely no legal architecture left to support the holding in Stone. It's a dead letter. Why force the Fifth Circuit to preserve a completely hollowed-out precedent just because the Supreme Court didn't explicitly write the word Stone on the tombstone in 2022?
Because it's not a charade. It is the fundamental operating system of the federal judiciary. Vertical stare decisis is essentially a strict military chain of command. A captain in the Fifth Circuit cannot just ignore a standing order from the generals on the Supreme Court, even if the captain thinks the generals have, you know, changed their overall strategic philosophy.
Even if the strategy is completely contradictory now.
Yes. The Supreme Court, in cases like Agostini and Rodriguez de Quijas, issued a crystal clear directive. If a precedent has direct application in a case, yet appears to rest on reasons rejected in some other line of decisions, the Court of Appeals should follow the case which directly controls. You leave it to the Supreme Court to overrule its own decisions.
But the majority argues that SB 10 isn't exactly the same as the Kentucky law in Stone. And more importantly, that Stone is so deeply intertwined with the Lemon progeny that Kennedy expressly abrogated it by proxy.
That is a massive interpretive leap for an inferior court to make. Stone dealt with the exact same core issue we have here, mandatory Ten Commandments displays in public classrooms. Kennedy dealt with a football coach privately praying on a field after a game.
True, the facts are different.
Kennedy did not mention Stone. It didn't mention classroom displays at all. A circuit court cannot just assume silent overruling because it feels emboldened. As Judge Haynes forcefully noted in her dissent, Stone makes SB 10 unconstitutional, and until the nine justices in Washington explicitly say otherwise, the lower court's hands are tied.
That is a powerful structural argument, I'll admit. But I would argue the Fifth Circuit majority isn't acting rogue here. They are attempting to follow the Supreme Court's explicit instruction in Kennedy, which was to stop using Lemon and start analyzing Establishment Clause claims through historical practices and understandings. Since they couldn't use Lemon to define what an establishment of religion actually is, they had to use a new framework, so they turned to the historical hallmarks of establishment.
Right. They pulled the six hallmarks from Justice Gorsuch's concurrence in Shurtleff.
Exactly. And let's pause to unpack what those hallmarks actually measure, because they aren't just a random checklist. They are control of ecclesiastical doctrine, mandatory attendance at religious services, financial support for a church, state-prescribed liturgy, restrictions on dissent, and civil disabilities for non-adherence.
All very high bars.
But if you look closely, these hallmarks all measure state force. They require some mechanism of government coercion for an establishment of religion to exist. The majority systematically walks through SB 10 and finds that a passive 16 by 20 inch poster hits zero of these markers.
I strongly disagree with the premise that it hits zero, but how do they justify that?
Well, by looking at the functional reality, SB 10 isn't forcing anyone to pray to the poster. The state isn't taxing citizens to physically build a Protestant church. The poster is simply placed on the wall. And regarding the text itself, the majority argues that the Ten Commandments have a shared pan-Judeo-Christian cultural resonance. It has immense historical significance in the development of Western law and American civic tradition.
But
Hallmark's test. The court is saying that acknowledging this historical significance through a passive display simply does not pull the levers of state coercion required to violate the Establishment Clause.
I'm sorry, but that cultural resonance argument completely falls apart when you look at the text of the statute, and Judge Higginson's dissent masterfully exposes this. The fatal flaw in SB 10 is that it doesn't mandate a generic, historically amalgamated version of the Decalogue. It mandates the exact verbatim text of the King James Version,
which is arguably the most historically influential English translation of the text.
It is undeniably a distinctly Protestant translation. How can the majority argue there is no state control of ecclesiastical doctrine, which is the very first historical hallmark you just mentioned, when the Texas legislature explicitly debated and chose the Protestant numbering and wording over the Catholic, Jewish, and Islamic traditions? This is something law students study deeply. The Jewish tradition includes, "I am the Lord thy God," as the first commandment, which the King James Version treats merely as a prologue. The Catholic tradition combines the prohibitions on false gods, engraven images, and splits the commandment on coveting into two. By mandating the King James Version specifically, Texas is officially preferring Protestant theology over other sects.
But look at the Supreme Court's own precedent in Van Orden versus Perry. In that case, the court allowed a Ten Commandments monument on the Texas Capitol grounds that used this exact same King James text. A majority of the court didn't find that specific text to be an unconstitutional denominational preference in that context.
Because Van Orden was a passive monument sitting outside on the Capitol grounds, where the primary audience consists of mature adults walking by. This is inside a compulsory public school classroom. Larson Valente clearly established that the clearest, most fundamental command of the Establishment Clause is that one religious denomination cannot be officially preferred over another.
Right.
And crucially, that doctrine from Larson survived Kennedy completely untouched. By choosing the King James Version, Texas is conferring an enormous benefit on Protestantism. It is elevating specific Protestant scripture as the official state-sanctioned text for every single classroom in the state.
I see the logic there, but typically, when courts look at denominational preference, they are looking for tangible material benefits or burdens, like a state granting tax exemptions to one sect but denying them to another, or allowing one religious group to use a public facility while banning a minority faith. Choosing a culturally ubiquitous, historically significant translation for a display doesn't restrict anyone else's actual right to worship.
I'd argue it does in a school setting.
But your point about the distinction between the Capitol grounds and the classroom brings us directly to the free exercise claims, which forces us to look at the recent 2025 precedent of Mahoub versus Taylor.
Right. The major Supreme Court case dealing with parental rights in public education.
Exactly. In Mahoud, a school district implemented a mandatory curriculum using storybooks that were designed to disrupt children's traditional beliefs about gender and sexuality. And the district refused to allow parents to opt their children out. The Supreme Court struck that down because it functioned as a compulsory curriculum that actively subverted parents' religious teachings. Naturally, the plaintiffs and Nathan tried to use Mahoud to argue that these Ten Commandments posters violate their free exercise rights in the exact same way.
And logically, they should. It is state-sponsored religious instruction placed in front of children.
The students aren't quizzed on the poster. They aren't graded on their adherence to its commandments. Teachers aren't required to read it aloud or offer theological reflections on what it means. It simply sits passively on the wall.
Passive, again.
Well, yeah. If we define the mere presence of religious text in a classroom as coercive, then we have to ask a really uncomfortable question about the Pledge of Allegiance. Millions of Texas students recite the pledge every morning, voluntarily saying one nation under God. If a passive poster is coercive, wouldn't the same logic demand that we abolish the Pledge of Allegiance entirely?
That is a classic false equivalent. As previous courts have consistently noted, the Pledge of Allegiance is fundamentally a patriotic exercise. It has a minimal historical religious component. The King James Decalogue is pure, unadulterated sectarian scripture. It contains explicit directives like, "Thou shalt have no other gods before me." That is not a generalized patriotic sentiment, you know? It is a rigid theological command.
But again, it's not a lesson plan. The teacher isn't enforcing those theological commands.
You keep falling back on the word passive, but I really challenge that definition when applied to a classroom. Judge Southwick's dissent captured the psychological reality of being a student perfectly. He compared the government promotion of religion in every classroom to simulated lightning and thunder, compulsorily seen and heard.
That's quite a poetic way to put it.
It is, but it's accurate. You don't have to give a child a multiple choice test on a poster for that poster to exert tremendous authority. It is officially sanctioned by the state. It is placed in a room where the teacher serves as an absolute authority figure, and it targets students who are highly susceptible to peer pressure and institutional conformity.
But does the presence of that authority actually restrict the parents' free exercise rights? Under the law, a restriction requires a substantial burden.
Yes, it severely burdens them. Let's look at the remedy you brought up in Mahmoud. You argue the poster is less intrusive than the storybooks in Mahmoud. But think about how Mahmoud functioned. In that case, parents could, at least initially, request opt-outs for their children from specific reading assignments. Under SB 10, there is zero mechanism for an opt-out.
Right, because it's a fixture.
Exactly. You cannot opt out of the architecture of the room. A Jewish or Hindu parent or an atheist parent sends their child to public school, and that child is forced to sit under a poster commanding adherence to Protestant theology for 8 hours a day. How does that not obliterate the parents' fundamental right to direct the religious upbringing of their children? The state of Texas is effectively saying to those parents, your religious teachings end at the schoolhouse door and ours begin.
I completely hear the emotional and psychological weight of that argument. But legally speaking, the Supreme Court in Kennedy was very clear that coercion means actual compulsion under threat of penalty, like a student being forced to pray or risk losing their spot on the varsity football team.
It shouldn't have to go that far.
But the majority, in Nathan points out, that SB 10 prescribes absolutely no penalties for students who ignore the poster, who openly disagree with it, or who question it. A free exercise violation requires a substantial, material burden on the practice of religion, not just daily exposure to ideas or texts you might disagree with.
But the exposure itself, when mandated by the state in a captive setting without any possibility of an opt-out, is the substantial burden. You are asking minor children to bear the psychological weight of defying the state's chosen religious orthodoxy every single day.
Well, when you step back and look at this 9-8 split, what you're really seeing is two entirely different definitions of what the Constitution requires in public spaces. From my perspective, Nathan v. Alamo Heights represents a necessary and long overdue doctrinal correction by the Fifth Circuit. By formally recognizing that Lemon and its progeny, including Stone v. Graham, are finally dead letters, the court has aligned public school establishment clause jurisprudence with the original public meaning of the Constitution.
So you're saying the historical test is just objectively better here?
Exactly. The historical hallmarks test provides courts with a concrete, objective standard. It properly distinguishes between a passive historical display, even one featuring religious text, and actual religious coercion that threatens free exercise. It respects the state's ability to acknowledge the deep historical role of religion in American law without crossing the line into actually establishing a state church.
And I maintain that the decision is a dangerous and deeply flawed overreach by an inferior court. It violates the foundational institutional rule of vertical stare decisis by discarding Supreme Court precedent on an assumption. It artificially narrows the definition of coercion to completely ignore the psychological and institutional realities of captive school children.
Which is a very real concern for a lot of people.
It is, and perhaps most troublingly, it permits blatant denominational preference. By elevating a specific Protestant translation into a mandatory fixture of public education, the court is completely overriding the rights of parents of minority faiths, or no faith at all, to direct their own children's religious upbringing.
What is absolutely undeniable is the sheer depth of the fracture on the Fifth Circuit here. I mean, a 9-8 split, with every single active judge feeling compelled to either write or join an opinion, is truly remarkable. It highlights just how unsettled First Amendment law remains in the wake of the Kennedy decision.
Absolutely. The question of whether the wall of separation still exists in public schools, or if it has been reduced to rubble by the abandonment of the Lemon Test, will almost certainly require the Supreme Court to step in and have the final word.
Which brings us back to where we started. If a state bolts sectarian scripture to the walls of a compulsory classroom, does it just become another passive architectural fixture like a whiteboard or a clock? Or does it fundamentally transform the foundation of a secular public education? We will leave that for you to decide.